From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And as anticipated, a key witness in the impeachment inquiry declined to appear today for a closed-door hearing requested by House investigators. Charles Kupperman, a top aide to former National Security Advisor John Bolton, filed a lawsuit on Friday asking a judge to decide what he should do since Congress ordered him to appear, but the White House ordered him not to. His lawyer said he could inflict grave constitutional injury if he picks the wrong choice. NPR's Domenico Montanaro is here. And Domenico, remind us why House lawmakers are so interested in Kupperman.
Well, as you noted, he was someone who was close to Bolton and was also close to President Trump in his capacity on the National Security Council and as the acting National Security Advisor. So, you know, Democrats have been wanting to draw a line here to see if there's more specifics on this aid for investigating conspiracy theories that would help the president in his reelection in Ukraine, and if the president was in fact directing this, as Ambassador William Taylor had laid out last week, and they're trying to build more of a case around that.
And wasn't Kupperman listening in on the call that President Trump made to the president of Ukraine?
He was, as several others were as well.
Well, House Intelligence Committee Chair Adam Schiff called Kupperman's failure to appear powerful evidence of obstruction of Congress. He said House Democrats don't intend to wait for the judge to resolve this and are prepared to move ahead with the inquiry. Here he is speaking with reporters this morning.
The lawsuit that Dr. Kupperman filed in district court has no basis in law. A private citizen cannot sue the Congress to try to avoid coming in when they're served with a lawful subpoena. We expect that the court will make short shrift of that argument, but nonetheless, we move forward.
And he also noted that other key witnesses who were also instructed by the White House not to cooperate with the inquiry did. Look, Kupperman says he could suffer constitutional injury or inflict it on either the Congress or the White House. But if the judge says you have to go, or if the judge says you don't have to go, how does that impact the whole inquiry?
Well, his attorney has said that if he is instructed to testify, he will. And this is really about this tension between the White House's exertion of executive privilege or constitutional immunity versus a congressional subpoena. And I think a greater plot line here below all of this is Ambassador John Bolton. The fact that Bolton himself was the National Security Advisor to the president, that Ambassador Taylor says that Bolton and Fiona Hill, who was working with Bolton, said that Bolton was very much against what he called a drug deal, saying that Rudy Giuliani was a hand grenade who was going to blow everyone up. That's the president's personal attorney who is engaged in leading this irregular channel pressure campaign. So Democrats and the Republicans on these committees are trying to fill in the gaps and figure out what really went on here. And I think Bolton, given the fact that he's not one of these anonymous career folks, he is he's a Republican. He's a conservative hawk who's somebody that a lot of Republicans will know and recognize from his days on Fox News and in the Bush administration. He carries a degree of credibility with Republicans that Democrats can use as pressure against them.
Look, this is a pretty brittle time. We saw Republicans kind of storm a closed-door hearing last week, continuing to say the whole impeachment inquiry is flawed. And then I just want to move over to today's news. President Trump said today that he did not inform the House Intelligence Committee about that raid that led to the death of ISIS leader al-Baghdadi because he doesn't trust Committee Chair Adam Schiff. Nancy Pelosi was also not informed. What kind of a government do we have, when the president doesn't trust a lawmaker to tell him about an event like, a raid?
Well, certainly the protocols in the past have been that maybe they're not members of the leaders of Congress or on either party are not necessarily told of specifics about a raid before they happen. They're certainly informed shortly thereafter when there's something of significance. In fact, Nancy Pelosi, House Speaker now, when she was a ranking member of the Intelligence Committee, was involved in understanding what was happening, for example, with Abu Ghraib, the prison in Iraq. A lot of Republicans or a lot of Democrats were critical of her because she knew information and didn't speak out about it because she had to keep quiet about it. So it's actually interesting that the president mentions her in particular, that he didn't think that she could keep this secret when she actually has in the past, because that's what was required.
And basically, we were not in pleasant times. Look, just very briefly, reports that freshman Democratic Congresswoman Katie Hill has resigned amid allegations she had an inappropriate relationship with a staffer. It is not allowed in Congress, but also these were pictures that were leaked by her estranged husband. She had been described as a rising Democratic star. This will hurt the party.
Yeah, and this is a competitive district, one that Democrats took over in 2018. That's certainly going to move a little bit more toward a more competitive race. But it's interesting here because this is something that's based on rules that were rewritten in 2016 or 2018.
Yeah. It is not allowed. Domenico Montanaro, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Californians today are dealing with another day of raging fires throughout the state. To the north, the Kincade Fire in Sonoma County that started last week has forced nearly 200,000 to flee and destroyed dozens of homes and other structures. And to the south, people in Los Angeles living near the Getty Museum are fleeing to escape a new fire that started there overnight. Joining us now for the latest is KPCC's Jacob Margolis. Jacob, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
So let's get right to it. Firefighters are calling the Getty Fire very dynamic. What's fueling it?
Yeah, so up in the hills where it's at, it's kind of these hills between the San Fernando Valley and the west side of L.A. They're nice, they're beautiful, big nature area that's just filled with chaparral, so lots of smaller, I guess, right as of now, dry, bushy plants, as well as some really big, tall trees down kind of in the little canyon areas. And what you have is just wind coming from basically the Great Basin, slamming into that area, pushing offshore, and some sort of spark started. And we're getting gusts up to, I think, 20 to 25 miles per hour, with later in the day expected around 45 miles per hour.
Oh my
and,
gosh.
And they drive the fire very fast. You know, not that long ago, just in 2017, there was a Skirball fire, which was on the opposite, people might remember, was on the opposite side of something called the 405, which is a major thoroughfare here in LA. And that burned, destroyed, I think, six homes and was really, really tough to put out and very scary. It's not a super populated area where the fire is burning currently, but there are homes. There look to have been some destroyed and, people's lives are at risk. It's a pretty big evacuation area.
Yeah, this area is not densely populated, as you said, but I'm wondering, do we have any indication of where it's headed?
Yeah, it looks like it's pushing. If you use the 405 as a barrier, which kind of sort of splits the mountain, I guess. If you draw a line from there all the way down to a place called Brentwood, Pacific Palisades, Topanga Canyon, it looks like the brush fire is pushing in that direction towards, I mean, the evac goes all the way down to the ocean. And so just imagine kind of it going, basically flowing downhill to the water from the top of these beautiful mountains. I go up there all the time. It's a wonderful recreation area, beautiful wilderness area with lots of dynamic vegetation, animals, and everything like that. So it's really sad to see it burn. But I was up there the other day and I was looking at it and thinking, it looks pretty lush. I wouldn't be surprised if it went up sometime soon.
Oh, man. You mentioned the mandatory evacuations for thousands of homes near the Getty Fire. I'm just wondering where people are actually going.
Yeah, it's really difficult to figure that out. I had to evacuate a couple of weeks ago for the Saddle Ridge Fire, and immediately, hotels book up right away. People, there are a number of evacuation centers that are also meant for large animals, which a lot of people are dealing with up in those areas, because it's a slightly more rural area of Los Angeles with big properties. And so I imagine people are heading to those places. But, LeBron James actually tweeted out that he had to leave and his family members had to leave their homes, and they're looking for basically a place to go. I'm sure it won't be too tough for him, but for a lot of people, they might be struggling to be comfortable for the next few days, to even be safe for the next few days, because a lot of places fill up very, very fast. And smoke, if the wind shifts, smoke becomes a humongous concern. And that's something we've now dealt with in the San Fernando Valley, where I'm at, for, my gosh, like an entire month now, it feels like. We've actually effectively taped off all our vents to the outside because we're tired of our house smelling like smoke. And I know a lot of people are dealing with that.
There's also the issue of power, of course, in other parts of the state where PG&E, the main utility, has cut off power to the north, Northern California. We've been hearing about blackouts in other parts of the state. What's the situation in Southern California and LA County specifically?
It's sporadic. It's going on. And people just kind of got to hold on. I know there's been a run on generators. I've talked to some stores that are out. I want to get a generator at this point. But, you know, our power system is a bit different than the one up north in those communities up in Northern California that are dealing with the Kincade Fire. We have seemed to have a little more variability in our area. It's really complicated, but hopefully the power doesn't go out for too long for folks.
Jacob Margolis is a science reporter for KPCC, and today he's reporting on the latest fires burning in Southern California. Jacob, stay safe, and thank you.
Thank you.
This message comes from NPR sponsor MindBody. MindBody connects millions to the widest variety of local fitness classes, and they offer the same experience when it comes to massage and acupuncture, spas and salons. Find, book, and pay all in one place. Owners can join the network at mindbodyonline.com/NPR. MindBody, your access to the largest consumer wellness network and marketplace.
Please join me now in welcoming Robin Young and Ronan Farrow.
The applause is for Ronan Farrow. Last week, he was greeted like a rock star at a Harvard Books event for his bestseller, Catch and Kill, Lies, Spies, and a Conspiracy to Protect Predators. In it, he details how he and NBC producer Rich McHugh uncovered sexual assault and rape allegations against movie mogul Harvey Weinstein. They also say NBC said their story wasn't reportable, told him he could take it to The New Yorker. Maybe, Farrow suggests, because Weinstein was letting his friends at NBC know, he knew they had their own problem looming in Matt Lauer. The book landed on the bestseller list like a hand grenade, and it's still reverberating. We watched backstage as Ronan fielded media requests.
He was being asked by media outlets to respond to the breaking news that an NBC official has just called him a terrorist. What I'm going to do
is... putting that in the Twitter bio.
Right up there with Pulitzer Prize winner.
After his New Yorker piece was published, Ronan Farrow shared the Pulitzer Prize with New York Times reporters Jody Cantor and Megan Toohey. Weinstein was charged with rape and other offenses. The Me Too movement was launched. This past weekend, out on bail, he showed up at a comedy club and was mocked from the stage. NBC denies Ronan's accounts that they silenced women as Weinstein did through non-disclosure agreements. But this past weekend, the network announced through MSNBC host Rachel Maddow that NBC employees with non-disparagement agreements are released from them. In 2017, when this story first broke, Rachel pressed Ronan on air to talk about NBC's role. This book is also part memoir. Ronan comes from a famous family familiar with allegations of abuse. We were reminded of that when I started a little bio.
So here's just a little bit. Ronan Farrow, son of Mia Farrow, Woody Allen. You were making your own bones as a serious writer. I'm going to get to that.
When I said Ronan was the son of Woody Allen, he gave a gesture kind of like, well, maybe not, referring to speculation that he's actually the son of Mia Farrow's former husband, Frank Sinatra. We touched on that. We'll link you at herenow.org. But Ronan says it's not important. What is his sister Dylan's claim that Woody Allen assaulted her when she was a child, and the claims of other women who've also been victims of private spy agencies, groups like Black Cube, hired by Harvey Weinstein, victims of tabloids, and media executives who further silenced them.
I was the beneficiary of incredible sources and whistleblowers who kept coming forward and refused to stop. This is also a story about the bravery of those women
Absolutely.
Who came forward and whistleblowers of both genders who help expose this entire operation.
We started our talk with Ronan Farrow with his early reporting at NBC.
very rapidly, I start to hear that this is about allegations of rape and sexual assault by Harvey Weinstein. Rose McGowan goes on the record, but she's not the only one. There are multiple named women. I obtain a secret police wire recording in which Harvey Weinstein admits to not just asexual assault, but a pattern of sexual assaults, and is in the midst of what sounds very much like preying upon a woman.
Many of us have seen that tape, that Amber Gutierrez, she's wearing the wire, and you hear him on the tape in the hallway say, I'm used to this.
I'm used to that, and she's clearly terrified.
On everything, I'm a famous guy.
I'm feeling very uncomfortable right now.
Please come in now, and 1 minute, and if you want to leave when the guy comes with my jacket,
you can go. Why yesterday you touched my breast?
Oh, please, I'm sorry, just come on, I'm used to that.
Are you used to that?
Yes, come in.
No, but I'm not used to that.
There's strange reactions and orders to put it on the back burner and hit pause and all kinds of euphemisms, and that does eventually then escalate to, you know, the president of the network, this guy Noah Oppenheim, on 6 occasions saying, you need to stop reporting on this. They ultimately have their lawyers threaten me if I ever reveal that they knew anything about the story.
And Noah Oppenheim, who, when at Harvard, wrote some of the most misogynist pieces about women, and he's now your boss, making decisions on this piece about women.
Right. I didn't know at the time, I should say, that he had written things like that women enjoy being preyed upon and pumped full of alcohol and, you know, really kind of endorsing sexual assault. And he's apologized for that since they've gone viral in the last few days and since they're in the book.
This was a place you admired. You even want to go back to NBC. At this point, the piece has been published. All heck has broken loose. They, of course, want you now. Come back and, you know, report on this for us. But Noah Oppenheim says to you, but don't mention the part about NBC. And you were conflicted until Rachel Maddow became the voice of conscience. It sounded like you needed to hear.
So, Ronan, you just said that one of these women spoke on camera back in January. Why did you end up reporting this story for The New Yorker and not for NBC News?
Look, you would have to ask NBC and NBC executives about the details of that story. I'm not going to comment on any news organization's story that they, did or didn't run. I will say that over many years, I am forthright about my own moments of cowardice in this, and at many points in this plot, I'm just a guy who wants to keep his job, and I've been fired over refusing to stop the reporting, but then it's dangled in front of me that I can come back.
If you don't talk about NBC.
If I don't talk about NBC. Rachel Maddow, you know, I've been assured no one is going to ask about it, but as tough journalists, including Rachel Maddow, grilled me about it, after which I burst into tears, and then we're both getting screamed at by executives afterwards. It's a scene. Also, the other thing that changed was sources began coming forward. In a time period where NBC was telling its journalists, we have no secret sexual harassment settlements, I lay out a paper trail of at least 7 of them. Several of them involving Matt Lauer. This is bigger than a story about NBC or AMI or Black Cube.
The owner of the National Enquirer.
It is about these systems of mutual protection among powerful people that lead to a situation again and again across industries where these problems are swept under the rug and paid out to make them go away. And the consequences of that are abusers stay in power and people continue to get hurt. In the world of media specifically, the truth gets hurt. Stories get killed. And I follow a trail of clues from how Harvey Weinstein weaponized the National Enquirer all the way up to how Trump weaponized the National Enquirer and used them to suppress stories. This had a bearing on our democracy. We've got to stand up and say enough and hold media accountable.
Well, there was someone else in your ear, and that's your own sister, Dylan. You're thinking about her and your family's connection to sexual abuse. Your sister, Dylan, accused Woody Allen of assaulting her when she was a child. You write that you spent most of your life avoiding her allegations. At one point, you describe a scene in which you said to her as an older child, you know, can you just move on? Can you just get over it? And you would call her on occasion while you were reporting, and her very quiet words, like when you were told to shut down, I think if I remember correctly, she said something like, I just remember all the times people, you know, didn't defend me.
Mm-hmm. It's tense. It was, you know, a searing process to have to confront these painful things in my own past, partly because As I report on each of these stories, there are these very below-the-belt attacks that try to weaponize every possible personal thing. You know, Harvey Weinstein's legal threat letters to me are not, shall we say, Hallmark card stuff. he's sicked his PIs on me, and there's a lot about my sister, and he calls at one point Woody Allen to kind of get advice, and then there's all these arguments in the legal threat letters directed at me about my sister being sexually assaulted and therefore me being too close to the issue.
Did he actually say to you, you couldn't, and I'm paraphrasing, you just couldn't save, you know, someone you loved, so now you're thinking you have to save other people, and this is your agenda. Did he actually say that to you?
He did.
Rose McGowan, this heroine of this story, a woman befriends her, claiming to be with a women's group, and they become very close friends. That woman is not with a women's group. She works for this Black Cube. She's trying to get information from Rose McGowan. Lisa Bloom, a well-known lawyer who starts calling you, how's your reporting going? How can I help? She's working for Harvey Weinstein.
Yeah, I get lied to a lot. Yeah, I mean, these are real betrayals. I mean, the lawyers, whether it's Lisa Bloom building a reputation on defending women, including my sister, author of many op-eds talking about the forensic credibility of my sister's claim, who then went on Harvey Weinstein's payroll and signed on to letters threatening me based on the argument that my sister was brainwashed. Not a good look for Lisa Bloom.
You get to the point where you move into a safe house. First of all, did you feel afraid? And did you feel crazy?
You know, what I experienced was a small shadow of what the sources were going through. You know, these were women who were gaslit in some cases in a very profound way, and who were, on top of all of that, re-traumatizing themselves by telling these stories and risking so much. So it helped, even at the time, to give me a sense of perspective that I knew that these women were doing such a brave and difficult thing. But I also try to be forthright in this book and vulnerable in this book about the fact that I was scared. And it sucked. And I did wonder if I was crazy until I got receipts and got all the contracts and got all the parties to these plots to admit to everything.
Except for NBC.
Except for NBC.
Would you do us a favor and just name some more of the women, because they are so heroic?
You read a story like Annabella Sciorra's. It's wrenching, violent stuff. Rosanna Arquette and Mira Sorvino and Daryl Hannah. But it's also worth noting that there were just as many people who are not public names. Lucia Evans, who is a marketing executive. I feel hope because in so many of the rooms where I document really bad things happening, there was also someone brave enough to speak up.
We thank all the women. We thank Dylan.
I thank them all too, and I thank you. And thank you, Robin.
Ronan Farrow, his best-selling new book is Catch and Kill. Again, both NBC and Harvey Weinstein deny his allegations that both silenced women with claims of abuse. Weinstein's trial begins in January. For our entire interview and Rachel Maddow on NBC's new stand on non-disclosure agreements, go to hereandnow.org.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
The federal budget deficit has hit its highest level in 7 years, according to new figures from the Congressional Budget Office, coming in at $984 billion this last fiscal year. It sounds like a lot, right? But some say not to worry about it. For more, let's bring in Jill Schlesinger, business analyst for CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
So this budget deficit is expected to top $1 trillion by 2020. Give us the long view here. How high is this historically?
Well, you know, first of all, trillion, big number, 12 zeros after a one. We have been here before. Remember that from 2009 through 2012, we did top $1 trillion for 4 consecutive years. So it's not that we've never seen it before, but it's still a big number.
Yeah, and that was during the Obama administration. Of course, there were lots of things going on during that time to juice the economy because of the recession. So why do we still have a deficit this high during a time of economic expansion?
I think that's the part that gets some economists a little bit concerned. They say, yes, of course, we run big deficits. We pile on debt when we have bad times because the government doesn't have a lot of choice. They're trying to create demand. They spend a lot of money. But what we also know is that the deficit has soared by nearly 50% since President Trump took office. So what really was going on? Well, a few of the things that have always been going on continue: demographic changes and promises the government makes. So the government says, hey, we're going to pay for things as you get older, Social Security, Medicare, there's Medicaid. All those things have continued. But in addition to that, we had the big tax cut. And that tax cut meant that companies and some individuals are paying less into the system. And the promise was that, yes, rates would go down, but economic growth would be so strong, we'd end up taking in more money. That actually hasn't happened. We had 1 year of growth at 2.9%. This year, we're back to about 2% growth. So still not enough money coming in.
So what's the worst case scenario if the government continues to spend more than it brings in taxes?
Well, you know, there are folks called deficit hawks, which are basically now extinct or near extinct species. Folks like Paul Ryan, who say that if you've got all this debt and all these deficits pile up year after year, ultimately it will lead to slower growth, higher interest rates, runaway inflation. But I have to say that has not happened yet. And so we've had these big budget deficits. We've had the national debt now approaching $23 trillion. We don't see inflation. We don't see high interest rates. And that means that a lot of economists are trying to scratch their heads and saying, maybe we need a new theory. This is called modern monetary theory. And so what they really are espousing and what people are thinking about is maybe we should be running bigger deficits to boost growth. And they're trying to figure out what is the right policy mix to make that happen. We don't know a lot about it. It's an emerging field over the last, say, two decades or so. It's going to get more play in the upcoming political campaigns. I promise we will talk about MMT again. But the best thing to think about is the question, what if larger deficits are not as bad as we previously thought? That's the key of it.
That's the key. Jill Schlesinger, CBS News analyst and host of Jill on Money. Jill, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Syrian Kurdish forces are on high alert in anticipation of possible riots after President Trump announced yesterday that ISIS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi died during a U.S. raid. This added to the uncertainty that already blanketed the region after Trump announced last week that U.S. troops would be pulled out. The New York Times reports that announcement sent the Pentagon scrambling to carry out Saturday's long-planned raid, which took place in the northwest Syrian province of Idlib. There are also tens of thousands of ISIS or Islamic State militants and their supporters still in prisons and camps in Syria. So what does the announcement of Baghdadi's death mean for ISIS, for the region? And why was he discovered in an area that is an al-Qaeda stronghold? They are sworn enemies of ISIS. Graham Wood is a lecturer at Yale University, staff writer for The Atlantic, author of the book The Way of the Strangers, Encounters with the Islamic State. Graham, welcome back.
Thank you.
And first of all, al-Baghdadi has been wrongly reported killed in the past. Do you have confidence in this announcement that he actually detonated a suicide vest, killing his children as well, after this U.S. raid?
Yeah, I think it's pretty likely this time. The reports in the past have not been from, I would say, very credible sources. The Russians said they killed him at one point. And, you know, we saw him on tape. It was definitely him as recently as April. So those previous reports were definitely wrong. This time, it seems pretty likely that they actually got him.
And remind us who he is. Many of us remember in 2014, he stood in the pulpit of a mosque in Iraq and announced that he was the caliph of the Muslim world. You know, remind us who he is.
So Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, his real name is Ibrahim Awad, and he's from Samarra, Iraq. He's from a Sunni family there and has a PhD in Islamic sciences from Saddam University. And other than that, we really didn't know very much about him, except that he was the head of the organization that later became ISIS and then the Islamic State since about 2010. And then, as you say, when he showed up at this mosque in 2014 in the city of Mosul after the city was sacked by the Islamic State, after being in the control of the Iraqi government. So ISIS came to town and surprised everyone by being able to take over the second largest city in the country. It was an incredible moment because this guy who had been in the shadows for several years, who nobody knew really anything about, was suddenly in HD announcing that he was the head of the entire world of Muslims, so 1.6 billion people perhaps. And from then on, he's been terrorizing 1.6 billion Muslims and everybody else too by saying that everybody has to go to bow down before him. And that includes, as you say, Al-Qaeda, who became his sworn enemy because they weren't so keen on acknowledging him as their leader.
So why would al-Baghdadi be in Idlib province, which is known to be an Al-Qaeda stronghold? Why was he there?
He was running out of options, so we don't know precisely why he went to Idlib, except that Idlib is one of these places, kind of like parts of Afghanistan, where it is impossible to invade Idlib. It's impossible to just control this territory that's so crenellated with caves, with mountains, with territory that's much more easily defended by on-the-ground kind of rebel forces. So ISIS had been its territory had been taken away in its kind of core areas of Syria, more in the desert regions. And Idlib might have been one of the last places where he could really hide, but it's not where he was from. So I have to admit, I was surprised to find that he was hiding out there. It's an unlikely place for a leader of ISIS to consider himself safe.
Do you think, as some are speculating, that it might mean that there's been some sort of a peace between ISIS and Al-Qaeda, some sort of merging?
No, I don't think so. That could happen down the line, but there were these insults that were thrown back and forth between ISIS and Al-Qaeda over the last 5 years, and they were really not things you can take back. So I would be very surprised if a real rapprochement was happening between ISIS and Al-Qaeda as a whole.
Each of them calling the other apostates, cowards, idiots, not something that could be healed.
Yeah, ISIS, in that famous propaganda of ISIS, you know, we'd see, first of all, members of Al-Qaeda having their heads cut off by ISIS. But also there would be ridicule sent back and forth saying, look, you, Al-Qaeda, for a long time, you were giving your allegiance and bowing down to Mullah Omar, who you recently admitted was dead for several of the last few years, the former leader of the Taliban. So ISIS really liked to needle Al-Qaeda, and as institutions, I think they were unlikely to be able to be quickly integrated. There is another thing to note, though, which is that they were once the same group. The people of these groups knew each other, and so perhaps Baghdadi had someone who was sympathetic personally to him, or someone he was willing to pay off to help him in a tight spot. We just don't know at this point.
Yeah. So what's the significance of Baghdadi? We'll get to where you see ISIS in this moment, but what did he do?
Baghdadi kind of flipped things on their head when it came to jihadist terrorism. So we had for a long time the most famous terrorist in the jihadist sphere was Osama bin Laden. And bin Laden, for all of his religious pretensions, he would talk about things like Israel, like authoritarians in the Arab world, saying these are the things that we need to fight against. And Baghdadi said instead, this is a religious war. We're thinking of history in cosmic, apocalyptic terms. And said it's not just what the king of Saudi Arabia is doing this decade. It's what we are doing in the grand scheme of Islamic history, which has gone back 1,400 years. And so by positioning himself as the heir to the Prophet Muhammad and some of the grand figures from a fantasy of what the Islamic past was, he was telling all Muslims that whether or not you like Israel or Saudi Arabia today, you have to come with me and fight on my side.
Yeah, well, and they did. People came from all over the world to fight with ISIS. But you write that his death will definitively end an era that had already, in a sense, ended, if not with a whimper, then with an inglorious bleeding of complaints from his own flock. You know, some people are thinking that this means ISIS is going to rise up again. You seem to say it's cinders at this point. Why?
I don't say that ISIS will never come back, but there was an offer that he was making to the Muslim world. Again, 1.6 billion Muslims and about 40,000 of them traveled to fight on ISIS's side. And the offer he was making was, you come and give obedience to me and I will offer you an Islamic State. I'll have territory where I will implement Islamic law in the way that the Prophet required. And it's been a long time since ISIS has been able to say, we control territory and we're offering a paradise. Instead, Baghdadi's been absent. There have been members of ISIS who have split with the group and have said, we just don't trust this guy anymore. He hasn't been around. We never see him. He doesn't seem to be able to give us safety.
And the Kurds managed to beat back ISIS in Syria.
Yes, a force of Kurds who are avowedly atheist managed to steamroll over ISIS. Mm-hmm. So when they were going to ISIS, they thought they were going to join a paradise where they could bring their families, and many of them did. And instead, they found that the person who was supposed to be leading them bravely in battle was gone for a year, 2 years at a time. And they thought that the deal was no longer a valid one.
It sounds like what you're saying is that the curtain is closing on a vicious, you know, almost, you know, barbaric in his rule, kind of Wizard of Oz. It's just there was not really a there.
By the end, he was a much more pathetic figure than I think anybody expected him to be. When he strode up to that pulpit and gave that speech in 2014, he really did look like he was stepping out of the 13th century and trying to continue a golden era that a lot of Muslims kind of had in the back of their mind but had never thought they would live to see again. And now, not just because of the words of the president describing his ignominious death, but because of the very fact that he was scurrying away for the last couple years of his life, you can't think of him in glorious terms anymore. He's a quite pathetic figure.
Graham Wood, staff writer for The Atlantic, author of The Way of the Strangers, Encounters with the Islamic State. Graham, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
There's a new guideline from the FDA. Pregnant women, stay away from cannabis. The warning comes as a host of new cannabis products flood the market, targeting women looking for relief from symptoms like aches, pains, and nausea. For more on why pregnant women should forego the use of cannabis, we're joined on Skype by Dr. Kelly Young-Wolf from Kaiser Permanente Health Systems. And Doctor, you and your team have been researching this for about a year now. What did you find?
One of the things that we're finding is that cannabis use in pregnancy is increasing. We found that about 4% of pregnant women screened positive for using cannabis in pregnancy in 2009, and that doubled to 8% by 2017. Something that was kind of alarming to us was that 22% of our pregnant teenagers and 19% of our pregnant young adults screened positive for using cannabis during pregnancy. And we also found that use in these younger age groups was increasing more rapidly than it was among some of our older pregnant patients.
Some of the reasons that women are using cannabis products to control morning sickness and other pregnancy symptoms, there are even some moms groups out there that promote this as basically a safer way to deal with these types of issues that you have during pregnancy. But what are you finding in regards to the possible harms of using marijuana or cannabis while pregnant?
I would agree. You know, I think women are getting a lot of information suggesting that cannabis use in pregnancy is safe from these moms groups, from, you know, just the fact that there's growing social acceptability of cannabis use in general, especially with legalization for recreational use. And I think pregnant women are inundated with messages from online media and from even cannabis dispensaries telling them that use in pregnancy is safe. Unfortunately, that is not consistent with what we're seeing in our research studies. And so I think it's important that women recognize that no amount of cannabis has been shown to be safe during pregnancy. We know that cannabis crosses the placenta and can reach the fetus. And there's actually substantial evidence that shows that using cannabis during pregnancy is associated with greater risk of having a low offspring birth weight. And there's also additional evidence that there may be some other harms, including things like problems with attention and memory, problem solving and concentration later on in childhood.
These types of findings, you're still very early, though, in discovering these. Is there a direct causation there, or is this a correlation that you're finding?
So, you know, that is a great question. And I will say that studying cannabis use in pregnancy is extremely challenging for a number of reasons. Well, one limitation to many of the studies is that they were done in the 80s. So many of the findings that are looking at the health effects of using cannabis in pregnancy are from data that are very old. And we know that the potency of THC, the potency of marijuana is increasing over time. So it's unclear how that might impact the risks. We don't really have a lot of new information yet to help us understand how these higher potency products could impact the fetus. Another thing that's really challenging is that there are increasing modes of administration. And so in the past, many people would smoke cannabis, but now we know that people are vaping cannabis and using edibles and smoking. And so, you know, we might think that smoking cannabis is going to have the greatest harms just due to the combustion of smoking and it reduces oxygen to the fetus. I think one of the issues is that the studies are finding conflicting results. And so part of that has to do with the methodologies. Different methodologies are used in different studies. Many of them don't account for co-occurring substance use. And in fact, one of the limitations to the research is that a lot of the studies, almost all of the studies, have been done using self-reported cannabis. In our own work in Kaiser Permanente, Northern California, where we screen all pregnant women for cannabis use by self-report and urine toxicology testing, has shown that women are about twice as likely to screen positive for using cannabis in pregnancy by a urine toxicology test as opposed to self-report. So studies that are relying just on self-report are likely underestimating actual use in pregnancy.
When you find out a woman has tested positive for cannabis use, what happens?
So we have a program that is really unique in Kaiser Permanente, Northern California, called the Early Start Screening and Intervention Program. And this provides a coordinated intervention to assist women in quitting substance use in pregnancy by actually providing a licensed clinical social worker or a marriage and family therapist who has expertise in substance use directly into the OBGYN clinic. So when a woman screens positive for using substances or tells their provider that they have used a drug during pregnancy, they can actually walk down the hall and within that same clinic be seen by a specialist who is an expert in substance use in pregnancy. And they can continue to meet with that person throughout pregnancy as needed.
Dr. Kelly Young-Wolf, a clinical psychologist with Kaiser Permanente Health Systems, recommending, along with the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, that pregnant women forego the use of marijuana and cannabis during pregnancy. Thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.